Okay, so as you notice on the slide, if you read this week in our current, I left off Matthew chapter 21 for our class discussion because that is where Matthew begins his account of the last week of Jesus' life leading up to the death, burial, resurrection. So I just decided to wait on discussing that until we read the other gospel accounts about the last week. And then there were other things in the readings this week that I thought were of interest. So that was my rationale behind that. Any of these questions we could talk about for a long time. The one that I have thought about the most this year is question two. That's why I ask another question about it. I've been wrestling with that myself for a little bit now. And then question four is interesting if you've never thought about that. Question five, we've talked about some, and question six is fun because of our recent deep dive into Jesus heals the blind. So we'll see how far we get in our discussion about each of these, but we'll start with the first one, Matthew 19, 1 through 12, and Mark 10, 1 through 12. And you'll notice I didn't ask a question about Jesus' discussion with James and John and their mom about greatness, because that is what I'm going to preach about this morning, greatness according to Jesus. So, question number one, Matthew 19, 1 through 12, and Mark 10, 1 through 12. What is from the beginning according to Jesus? There's more than one answer there, but that's the language he uses. What is from the beginning? Gender. Gender distinction is from the beginning. What is not from the beginning? Gender fluidity. That is not from the beginning. God created them male and female. Male and female created he them. And so Jesus makes that point in verse 4. And how does he introduce it? What does he say to introduce it? Have you not read? And specifically, have you not read what? And where's that found? In Genesis. Yes, chapter 1. I mean, depending upon the font of your Bible, page 1. Okay, so look, you know, this class is not, you know, the public forum where we would discuss issues, but, you know, in the public forum where people discuss these issues that are relative to everybody of all time, you know, our faith is ridiculed for being simplistic and that we have put our faith and our hope and our trust into this book of antiquity. This is why I constantly am making the point, and I think this is why it is imperative that we get this point into the minds of our children and into their hearts. The simplicity that is Christ Jesus. If you understand who he is, when he makes a statement like, have you not read? And then he quotes Genesis 1, 26 and 27. What should that say to you about Genesis 1, 26 and 27? It matters. And how long has it mattered? And how long will it continue to matter? It's just that simple. And when people just struggle with the simplicity of it, and, you know, you're never going to be woke. There's always going to be more woke. So the woke of today will not be the woke of tomorrow, because the whole mindset behind being woke is what? Progressivism. So we progress to a certain stage. We level up, and then what do we do again? We just keep leveling. Until what? Until there's just nothing. It's just nonsense. It already is nonsense. But it doesn't have to be from the beginning. So we ought to read Genesis. We ought to be convicted about it. It's not a creation myth. It's the creation account. And from the beginning, God said. So last week when we talked about Jesus wept, we need to consider his word, which is what Martha needed. We need to consider his heart, which is what Mary needed. And we have both in this. I mean, all that Jesus is talking about here, it's very emotional stuff. It is issues of the heart. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage, that's very emotional stuff. gender issues, homosexual issues. I mean, all of that, LGBTQ, all of it. It's very emotional. You're not going to out-emotion Jesus. You're not going to out-love Him. You're not going to out-grace Him. You're not going to out-mercy Him. You're not going to out-compassion Him. You're not going to out-think Him. You're not going to out-nothing. And so, what is it all about? No matter where you stand, in Matthew 19, 1 through 12, it doesn't matter where you stand, what is it about? It's about sin, and it's about selfishness, and it's about a lack of self-control, and it's about temptation, and it's about lust, and it's about, I want to be, you know, the captain of my ship. And so what does Jesus say in response to all that? Have you not read from the beginning? You're not the captain of your ship. You're a created being, and you've been created in the image of the true and living God, who has a will that He wants you to conform yours to. And when you do that, Genesis 2, what does that look like? It looks like walking in the cool of the garden with the God and Father who created you. When you try to go your own way, what does that look like? Genesis 3, now where are we? East of Eden. And a whole world of sin-cursed possibilities have opened up to us, which include, verse 12, there are those who are born eunuchs. Well, they wouldn't have been born eunuchs in the Garden of Eden. That's a consequence of the fall. Now, if you're born a eunuch, you know what I think that does to Jesus? I think that makes Him weep. Because that's not from the beginning. That was not ever His will for you. But if you were born a eunuch, what are you going to have to do? You're going to have to deal with it. I didn't choose red hair. And my hair is not red anymore. I don't even know what color it is. But it used to be red. And so from the first day of kindergarten until the day I graduated high school, do you know what people made fun of me for? Having red hair. It was just misery. I mean, I can't tell you the number of days that I just thought, why can't I just have black hair like everybody else? Or even brown. I didn't choose that. And there is a space for us to be honest about all the choices that we didn't get to make. Free will is a thing. And free will is a thing from where? From the beginning. But I didn't choose my parents. I didn't choose to be born where I was born. I didn't choose the time. I didn't choose my gender. I didn't choose this. I didn't choose that. But this is it, and I got to deal with it. I didn't choose my talents. I didn't choose my skill set. I don't choose my brethren. So, where are all of us? We're on the same playing field. No matter what you believe, what is God's will for you? To conform what you believe to what He knows is what? True. And that's a process for each and every one of us. I may not be tempted by some of the things that people in those communities are tempted by, but I understand temptation, and so do you. And the process is the same. Here's something I want. God says that's not good for you, and I, you know, essentially say to Him, I know better than you, and I'll show you how good it is for me. And that grieves Him. That grieves the Holy Spirit of God. Ephesians 4:30. It grieves Jesus. And so much of our problem could be corrected from the beginning. So very good. Sister Ramsey started from the beginning with male and female. What else is from the beginning? What does that segue into?
The law of marriage.
The law of marriage. And where's that from? It's from the beginning. So we got Adam. He's incomplete. He doesn't give Him another man. He doesn't give Him an animal. Shows Him all the animals. And what was the point of that? To show Him that there's not one compatible to you. That wasn't the point. The point of making the animals was not so that you could have companionship. It was never God's will for man to have a dog as his best friend. That's not from the beginning. I don't know where that's from. That'd be fun to Google. What's the origin of that? It's not Genesis 1. From the beginning, man was incomplete. He was alone. And what did God do for man? He created woe man, woman. And so, how do we know that God's marriage law from the beginning is God's marriage law from the beginning that He intends for us to respect until the end? What's the obvious implication of the language at the end of Genesis 2. Who were the only two people on the earth at the time? Adam and Eve. What could Adam and Eve literally not do within the context of God's law on marriage? They couldn't go back to their family. And they couldn't go back to their family because they couldn't leave their family. Because they didn't have a family to leave. Do you see that? So when we think about what's from the beginning, okay, God creates Adam and Eve. That's the beginning. Male and female. God creates marriage. And who is marriage to be between? It's to be between a male and a female. And so what is a male and what is a woman, a female to do? They're to leave and they're to cleave and they're to become one flesh. And how long is that relationship to last? To quote Randy Travis, forever and ever. Amen. Is marriage only a civil act? Matthew 19, verse 5, quoting Genesis 2, 24. Is marriage just a civil act? There's another expression that's being used a lot lately. I didn't write it down, so I can't remember it. What happens when a man leaves his father and mother and becomes one flesh with his life? What happens there? God joins them together. Yeah, I said verse 5, which is the language of Genesis 2. And then Jesus explains it in verse 6. That's one of those fun passages. Just so there won't be any, you know, doubt or misunderstanding. So then, they are no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. So, it's not just about civil law. Because who does the joining? God. And that's why some marriages are adulterous, because God doesn't join them together. People can get married, but God doesn't join them. Which was the problem that Herod and Herodias had, that John the Baptist pointed out. And Herodias, one of the gospel writers, maybe Mark tells us that she was the one that she didn't like that. So what did she do? Yeah, I mean, it's emotional, right? I mean, I've never known anybody that was in an unlawful marriage that wanted to talk about it or was happy to talk about it or, you know, couldn't wait to hear about it. So Greg and Tony and I on Wednesday nights for a full year and into this year have been teaching our kids, and we haven't soft soaped it. We have really hit this hard with them, and I'm prayerful for all of our kids, mine included, that they understand this from the beginning of their lives and that they don't make a mess of their lives through marriage, divorce, and remarriage, because you can sure do it. And in case there is any doubt about what Jesus meant when he said verse 9, there's one exception. What did the disciples say in verse 10? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's just not a whole lot of "I'm okay, you're okay, we're all okay" in Jesus' teaching and in people's understanding of it. Right? They're hard sayings. And so in John 6, we got hard sayings that aren't even as emotional as these, and people turn and walk no more. And you can understand why people get upset with Matthew 19, 1 through 12, and Mark 10, 1 through 12, because that right there covers a lot of what we're talking about in our country and major changes that have taken place. And, you know, the reality is the disciples, Jesus himself, the disciples, they weren't down, you know, they weren't making trips to Rome to protest and to march and to do all that. I mean, you know, in Acts 17, when Paul talked about turning the world upside down, it wasn't through, you know, sex strikes and hashtag, all that bunch of garbage. The way they turned the world upside down was through preaching Christ and Him crucified. There is another King. And so this is the crux of the whole matter, going back to last week and as we continue to go forward. If you're going to be a Christian in the world, and we are in the world, we are in the world, but we are not of the world. We are in the world. And Jesus doesn't pray that the Father would take us out of the world. He prays that He would sanctify us. And how does He sanctify us? By Thy Word, which is truth, John 17:17. So, to be in the world, whether you live in the United States of America or Canada or Mexico or wherever it is, you live within the context of two laws. Which law is to reign supreme in your heart? The law of the King. And that's what the kingdom is all about. The kingdom is primarily about the rule of God in your heart. So you can live in a country in which you can marry and divorce and remarry willy-nilly all day long to anybody and everybody, and I'm okay and you're okay and it's all okay. But the reality is we serve another king. And what is His name? Jesus. And from the beginning, He said all this. And God help us to glorify Him through our example primarily, but also through our teaching. Thoughts about this before we move on to number two? Brother Greg.
I would add that there's truth and there's falsehood, and there's no place in between. There's no interpretation of asserting some sort of allegiance to Jesus, but then rejecting
I like how you said that. I'm going to stick that on the slide. I see so much of that. The sign I drive by to get to our church building out in front of another church. I mean, you can't just love Jesus and not love what He said. I mean, you don't have to use a red letter Bible. But to Greg's point, I mean, to not believe the red letters and then to still call upon the name of the Lord, that dishonors Him terribly.
It's a deception from Satan.
Absolutely. That we can have our cake and eat it too. I mean, that's what it is. And I don't know why I've always struggled with that expression, but I finally get it after 40-something years of thinking about it. But that is exactly what we want: Jesus, but we also want our unlawful marriage, whatever form it takes. We want both. I don't know why I've always struggled with that illustration, but I have. And I don't know why I've always struggled with this, but I have. And I've been working a lot on this lately, which is the second question if we want to move on now. So, you know, going back to Matthew 18, where Jesus calls the little child and sits him in the midst and says, "Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." And then he has another episode with children in Matthew 19 and in Mark 10. "Then little children were brought to him that he might put his hands on them and pray, but the disciples rebuked him. Then Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me and do not forbid them, for as such is the kingdom of heaven.'" And then in one of the other accounts, he talks about, the first shall be last. And if you want to be great, be low. So, you know, how do you understand that? I really am interested to hear what you say, what you have to say. So I'm going to shut up now. What do you think all that means?
State of now. cheated the dollar an hour, and I cheated the little thing now. That's what we're doing, and I can pretend it now, I have what I need right now, but I'm not worried about tomorrow or a year from now.
Gene Cooper. So I've been raising teenagers, Brother Gene. And I can tell you that over the course of the last couple of weeks, I have read every book in my library about Matthew 18 and Matthew 19 and the Mark and Luke passages. And there is not a general consensus about how old any of these children were. So in Matthew 18, this child, this little child, is old enough for Jesus to call him and for him to come. In the other examples, Jesus is taking children into his arms. He's holding them. Okay? So the one thing that everybody is sure of is that this isn't talking about teenagers. Okay. So I look at that child in Matthew 18, and I really do think that I probably wouldn't struggle with it as much as if I could see the child. I don't think they had as much trouble understanding it as I do, because it was an object lesson, right? Well, I wasn't there. So, I mean, one of the things I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, what is it about the child? If I had been there and I had seen the child, what would I have seen in the child? What would I have thought? When I saw Jesus call the child and then to hear him say, and this is why I think this is so important. I think I've struggled with this for a long time, and it's bothered me that I've struggled with it, because the language that Jesus uses elevates the importance of understanding it, right? Assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means. That is very strong language. I mean, the construct of 18:3 is very similar to John 3 and Jesus' discussion with Nicodemus about entering the kingdom and unless you are born again. Okay, and I do think there's a connection there that I will talk about if no one else does. But the stress he lays on understanding this, it's just bothered me that I've struggled with it so much. And then he uses the word humble in verse 4. Now I'll tell you why that's been such a problem for me. In my experience with teenagers, there's not a lot of just humility there. And then depending upon the child, I've known some kids that I didn't necessarily think were humble as I understand humility. So then I've had to think about, okay, do I understand humility? What does that mean? What does it mean to humble oneself as the little child? So that's bothered me. And then the reception of the child in my name, that doesn't bother me as much. I think I understand that part of it. And then I think I understand the other example much better. You know, holding the child, saying, let the little children come, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. So the specific question is, you know, how do you understand this particular verse? But I think that they're all connected. So a bunch of hands are going up, which thrills me to no end. And I don't remember the order in which they went up, but I think Wade didn't raise his hand. You didn't raise your hand? Well, then you don't get it. Glenda.
So I think he's saying that's what you have to do.
Matthew 5:3, which is the first of the Beatitudes that introduces the Sermon on the Mount, which is the gospel of the kingdom, which begins with the characteristics of the kingdom citizen. First one out the chute, poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I agree. I believe you're spot on. I agree with what James said too, and I'm not mad at your question. It's a good question. Tony, Bella, and Brad. That's good. I've thought all that through recently. I like that. I think that's a good place to think in all this. So before I go to Bella, here's the context of it. What are the disciples arguing about? Greatness in the kingdom. Now, let's put it into a little bigger context. What did Jesus tell Peter in Matthew 16:16-18? What did he tell Peter specifically? I'll give you the keys to the kingdom. Well, how do you think the others felt about that? Well, yeah, we don't have to wonder, because that's what they're arguing about all the time now. They're arguing about who's going to be the greatest. So you take the list of the apostles, you look at everything that God's revealed to them, revealed to us about those guys. Andrew could have easily said, well, it's going to be me, because I was the first one called and I was the first one that accepted the invitation. I'm the first one who came. Obviously, I'm going to be number one. Well, Peter got the keys, but what did Peter, James, and John get to do in Matthew 17? Well, one of the reasons why Jesus might have said to them, don't tell anybody about this, is because he knew the others were already concerned about who was going to be the greatest. And now they're going to think, well, that's not fair. And I guarantee you that's what I would have thought. Man, in my carnality, I'd have been so upset that I missed out on that. I mean, that is one of the advantages to where we stand, right? We get to see all this by faith, but, you know, don't tell anybody about it. And so, you know, as far as like the object lesson and striking at the heart of their problem, to take a little child and to put it in the midst of them and to say to them the words that he said, you would think that would get their attention. Did it? No. Matthew Henry is a book that I've had in my library for a long time that I never read, but I'm telling you, I read everything in my library about this over the last couple weeks. And man, he has a great quote about it, talking about how once the fires of envy are lit, they are hard to put out. Man, that is well said. That's why it is so important that we get a handle on that. And while that sin falls within the context of self-control, and what you put into your mind and what you allow to come out of your mouth and all of it. I mean, they are just continuing to argue about this. And then after the resurrection, they even say, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom of Israel? They still don't understand the concept of the kingdom. And they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest in it. And what does Jesus do? He puts a little child in their midst. And then they're trying to forbid children from getting up into his wheelhouse, because in their minds, what do great men not do? They don't mess with kids. And so what does Jesus say to them? This is what the kingdom is all about right here. Of such is the kingdom. I mean, they're arguing about who's going to be the greatest, and Jesus is literally calling out their childishness with the illustration of a child. I mean, it's humbling to me, which I'm coming to Bill after I make this point. I think this is one of the reasons why I've struggled so much with this, is because my concept of humility probably isn't in line with what Jesus is saying. What does the word humble really mean? What does it literally mean? Low. What are they aiming for? They're aiming high. And Jesus says, it's okay to aim. That's what our lesson is going to be about this morning. He tells them how to be great in Matthew 20 and in Mark 10. It's okay to aim high. But to aim high in the kingdom is to be what? Low. So the question then becomes, okay, to James' point, and what is it about this little child that's low? So I have more to say about that in a second. Bella. That's a good word. I don't think I can pronounce it, which is why I wasn't saying it, but it's good. You said it beautifully. That. Good point. Man, I've thought a lot about that this week. I mean, you take these events and you stick them into their immediate context, and then you look at them in a broader context, and then you look at them in the big picture, and it's like the disciples are arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom, and Jesus essentially says to them in Matthew chapter 8, verse 3, y'all ain't even in it yet. You're talking about being great in it unless you are converted. Okay, so tying that back to Nicodemus, Nicodemus couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that he needed to change anything. That was a primary problem of all the Jews. What, me convert? Me change? Abraham's our daddy. Moses is our daddy. David is our daddy. What are you talking about? What do we need to change? Oh, by the way, Nicodemus, you need to be born again. You need to be born again of the water and the Spirit. Assuredly, I say to you, Nicodemus, assuredly, I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. I mean, to Bella's point, that is how I see this. Here is this small child who is trusting, who Jesus says, come, and they come. And when the child comes, he puts the child in the midst and he says, you guys are arguing about who is going to be greatest. And unless you become like this little child, therefore, whoever humbles this child. When that little child came to Jesus, what did that child not come with? It didn't come with any achievements. It didn't come with any accomplishments. It had no developed skills. It didn't have any stature of any kind. And point of fact, it didn't have a resume. Now, that's not how we do things, is it? That's not how we measure greatness. I mean, going back to a couple weeks ago when I put the picture up of my kids from when we were here 10 years ago, and one of my kids asked, you know, why do some presidents have a monument and others don't? Well, because we've made some judgments, right? And we've said, okay, what does their resume look like? What did this person do for the country? Oh, okay, well, they deserve this. And Jesus says there's just none of that in the kingdom. In the Gentiles' kingdoms, we got leaders who lord it over. Not so. That's not the kingdom of heaven, and that's not the kingship of me, and unless you are converted and become like this. Okay? So when we think about all the other language, and I'm coming to you next, Brad, when we think about the other language where he's talking about least of these, and what is it about this little child that sets it apart from the rest of society? In antiquity and in first century way of life, how were children regarded? They had absolutely no legal rights. This is reflected in the next parable Jesus tells in Matthew 18 and in verse 25. When he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and his children and all that he had, that payment be made. I mean, children were viewed as property. Children and slaves were on the same level. They were regarded as having the same social status. They were at the bottom of the ladder. They were the lowest, if you will. They were the humblest. So here are the disciples, and they're thinking about all the great things that they've done. Remember in Luke 10, which is what prompted us, you know, talking about the memorials and all that? Jesus gives them the power. What do they come back and do? Jesus, you won't believe all the great stuff we did. And what did Jesus tell them? Don't rejoice about that. Rejoice in what? That your names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life and in heaven itself. But they're still thinking about chief seats. You know, Judas was the treasurer. What do you think he might have been dreaming about? Secretary of the Treasury. James and John, the sons of thunder. Well, let's get them over at state. Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. Raining fire and brimstone down on folks. They're good candidates for that. So, I do think this is really layered. And I think there is a lot to think about, and I think we need to come to terms with it. And I have one other thing to say, unless others want to talk. Brad.
So, Jesus is the best community to ever live.
Yes.
This is an analogy, and it's likely, you know, I imagine the context of the Lamb of the Saints. He's seen kneeling down, extending his hand, you know, the child running to him. Jumping into his arms and clinging to him with joy and grief. Maybe Jesus spun around before he said the rest of his statement. I see getting at to the heart of those that he wants in his kingdom. To use an analogy to bring it to this day in Egypt, have you ever listened to the sound of the children running upstairs to sing after services, to sing praises to God and to commune with Him in that way? That's the joy and the pureness of heart that I think that longing for us to have as we see God.
Yeah, and going back to Glenda's statement about Matthew 5:3, I mean, there definitely is an innocence to this. I mean, you know, Don Henley wrote the song "The End of the Innocence," and I think that that's part of it, right? I mean, we grow up and we are innocent, and we have this simple trust and faith in our parents, guardians, whatever. I mean, when my mom and dad told me that I was their son, I believed them. I didn't question that. When they brought Jillian home from the hospital, "This is your sister," okay? I mean, speak, Lord, for your servant hears. That was the attitude of heart that Eli told Samuel. That's what you need to have. That's what you need to say. And so, you know, when you think about the innocence, but also just the weakness and the vulnerability and the dependence, the simplicity of it. Man, we struggle with that, don't we? I mean, that is so countercultural to the world in which we live. Any world. It was countercultural to their world, and it is to ours. And when you look at what Jesus says in Matthew 18:3-5, it just makes it so important that we understand it. So the passage that I keep referring to that I am not quoting correctly, that I want to quote correctly now, is Mark 9:37. Mark 9:35. He sits down and he calls the 12 and he says to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." And then he takes the little child. I mean, he makes that point. He teaches them that lesson before he puts the child into their midst. So what does he put into their midst? He puts into their midst someone who is on the lowest level of society. Here is a person who could do nothing for them, except, to elaborate on what Brad is saying, bring joy. I mean, the most joy that my kids have ever brought me is when? When they weren't talking back. I mean, you know, in that age of innocence, before that ended. And I didn't write down the day or the hour or the minute when it ended, but we all know, right? I mean, it just goes from, you know, I'm trying not to use an example of our people. But they're not here, so I will. We have two little twin girls among us right now, and if I called either one of them to me, they would come. The way they love their dad right now and the way they love their mom, that's what Jesus is talking about, I think, when it comes to thinking and speech and behavior. And so the other thing that I would add to it is, and I don't know where I read this. I need to go back and find the actual source of this. I don't think Jesus is necessarily talking about a subjective attitude. I think he's talking about an objective state. There is an objective state in which children are, to go back to Glenn's point, until they're not. And it's within that objective state that Christ is putting a child who's in that state into their state and saying, this is the game changer right here, guys. This, you got to change your, you got to be converted. You got to change your thinking. I mean, we've been walking around now for 3 years telling everybody else that they need to change their thinking. You need to change your thinking. And unless you change your thinking, you're by no means are you going to enter into the kingdom. And then he comes back in Matthew 20 and in Mark 10, which those passages are much easier to understand, in my opinion. That's why I'm preaching on them instead of preaching on this. But he says the same thing to them in Matthew 20 and in Mark 10 without using the children. So when he talks about anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. Jesus served children. And Jesus also served slaves. And the disciples in their minds are above all that. And are trying to prevent Jesus from doing it. And Jesus says to them, no. You guys, unless you're converted, you won't even enter it. Which is a lesson he had been teaching the Pharisees over and over again. And in this last week, boy, is he going to drop the hammer on them for that. I know other hands went up, but I apologize. James.
And so up until a certain age too, children really want to be like their parents. And I, as a father, I think about that. And they really want to be like dad. And some age, some of us kind of get away from wanting to be like our physical father or our earthly father. But that's I think that's another kind of layer that we could add to that too, is that as a child who's dependent on their parents, they want to be just like dad, they want to be just like mom, and that should be our attitude as well. Be just like God, be just like Jesus. So I want to have that kind of attitude, I'll be in their image, I'm a child of theirs, and so I want to act like them. They know what's best for me, and I want to do those things that they want for me.
Yep. And again, it just goes back to the lowliness aspect of it, you know. I think. Well, if you come up to me after class and you say to me, Jason, I think you've just been overthinking all that. You might be right. What did the rich young ruler ask Jesus? That. That's a good question. And I think the takeaway from that, I mean, clearly this is the point he's making, but I think one of the takeaways that we ought to make for that is, you know, obeying the gospel is the same thing for everybody, but repentance is not. Wherever you are in your life, Jesus is going to call you to count the cost. And it may not be money. It may be an unlawful spouse. It may be a number of things. But the question becomes, for me personally, what must I do to inherit eternal life? It was personal for him. It's personal for you and me. Does the Annandale Church have apostles? Question four, as the bell rings. That was perfect timing. No. The Annandale Church does have apostles. And this is their role in the regeneration. Their role in the regeneration is to govern us by what? By the word that they received from whom? Who told them that he was going to send whom to them? To guide them into what? So there you go. If someone says, does the Annandale Church have apostles? There's a new church out on our road, and it says Church of the Apostles. And I thought, well, you didn't get the foundation. What's the foundation? And then what was built upon the foundation? So let's go back to the foundation. That's fun to talk about. I think they just couldn't believe it. And boy, that's good. Thanks for your good attention and participation. I like our discussion. It was helpful to me. I hope it was helpful to you.